Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist and broadcaster Helen Fospero. When I talk to people who've never been to Canary Wharf in London, some still imagine a somewhat soulless business district inhabited by bankers, very much a New York-style financial hub. But how wrong they are. Over the last few decades, it's grown and developed into a vibrant destination, boasting some of the finest shops, restaurants, bars, artwork, events, green spaces and stunning apartments, as well, of course, as top businesses and FTSE 100 names. A real city within a city. Camille Waxer, Canary Wharf Group PLC's Chief Administrative Officer for many years and MD of Retail, has been there since it was little more than a building site in the early 90s, and is credited by the FT and others with helping transform the former Docklands wasteland into one of Britain's most successful retail sites. And I'm delighted to say Camille is my guest this week. Camille, thanks very much for joining me. I know you're probably cringing at the plaudits there, but you're very, very low key, aren't you, about what you've achieved?
Yes, I am. It's been a joy, actually, over the last 30 years. So, yes, to hear that is a little bit overwhelming.
So let's go back to those early days, if we may. What are your memories of what Canary Wharf looked like when you first arrived?
It was a huge building site, absolutely huge. I'd never seen anything like it. And there was just thousands of people working on it and so many cranes. And I just saw that this was going to be the best project ever in London and possibly in the UK and beyond.
I was looking through the archives last night, actually, at pictures from the 90s. And it's interesting you mentioned the cranes there. It really was a sea of cranes,
yeah.
and vast swathes of mud and wasteland, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. All around us. And then, of course, but funny enough, through it was the Docklands Light Railway. And this little train would come through every hour or so. And that's how a lot of the people would get to the area, the Docklands. So it was just a bit surreal having these huge buildings going up and this little train going through it.
And was it a case of Wellington boots and that kind of thing? I mean, was it dirty? And
it was very dirty. So it was construction boots and hard hats. And you worked in a porta cabin. And pretty much all of the people on the site were men. So they weren't used to having women on the site. So that was the first change for me, because in Canada, women are on construction sites or were on construction sites. So it was very different being the only woman on a construction site.
I'm sure we can tell from your accent that you are from Canada. Were you headhunted for the Canary Wharf role?
Yes, I was. I was working on a project in Toronto. I'm from Toronto, and I was working on a project called Hazelton Lanes. And they came around and said, okay, who was in charge of the construction of all the retail shops? And they pointed them in my direction. And then I just came over probably within 3 weeks and started working on the project.
So what was your actual role in those days?
So my role was to bring all of the foul sewer lines and the water and the sprinkler lines, etc., into the retail units. And then when the retailers would come on board, I would review all of their drawings and make sure that they met up with all of the construction drawings.
I've in recent years popped into your beautiful management floor at Canary Wharf and the big glass windows looking out at amazing views over the city. But you mentioned there, I mean, porta cabins really were more the order of the day when you started. What was it like working in what was very much seen, certainly in this country, as a bit of a man's world, really?
Oh, it definitely was a man's world. There's no doubt about it. I would sit in a porta cabin with about 15 men, all smoking, which I also wasn't used to, that people would be smoking. And they would ignore me at the beginning. And I just sort of sat there and listened. And I didn't really say much. And you could sort of tell they thought, well, what point is she going to say anything? But I wanted to hear what they had to say. And I had to understand how this project was working and how we would work together. And then slowly I started to say something. I would say, okay, I think for this unit, we have to do this. And for this unit, we're going to have to make some changes. And then they started to listen. And then actually some of them are my best friends.
Are they really? That's amazing. Didn't you tell me, I think once, that you used to have your cigarette outside the porta cabins with them and start to sort of build that relationship, I suppose, showing that you were very much one of the team?
Yes, absolutely. And one time, there was one fellow I couldn't quite... I don't know, he wasn't ready for me yet. And he handed a unit over to me, and I had to give it to a pub. This was the official handover of our first retail unit. Well, it was actually a pub at Canary Wharf. And it wasn't ready, so I went in at midnight and I swept it, because as part of the lease, it has to be broom swept. That is part of the condition. And it wasn't. So I got a broom and I swept the whole unit. And I left, and I was crossing the bridge at 5 a.m. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "You didn't do your job. So I did it." And then after that, he couldn't do enough for me. I actually won over his respect.
I think as well, throughout your career, you've probably always taken that attitude, haven't you? That when necessary, you roll your sleeves up and you get things done.
Yeah, very much so. It is the way I am. And I think it's important, especially when you're trying to develop such a huge development, you have to do that.
So when you got there and you looked at this piece of ground and the building site, did you have a vision at that point for what you were going to create, or were you sort of doing it building block by building block? Did you have any idea, I suppose, is what I'm trying to ask, that it would end up the sort of destination that it is now?
Well, we believed it was going to be, because I remember going to the marketing suite and they said, "This is going to one day house 100,000 people, 16 million square feet." And I thought, yeah, I'm in. That sounds good. There was a master plan. It was by SOM. And we built it. We built it according to the master plan. And that was up until about 2016. So we're now expanding on that.
And is it true that you only intended to stay 5 years?
Two.
How come you stayed so long?
I absolutely love it. At the beginning, I found it really hard with the pollution. And I found the fact that there were so many people. I came from Toronto. Toronto is sort of a busy city, but nothing like London. But I love the project so much. I was addicted to it. I still am. I mean, I still think Canary Wharf is the most amazing place. And the years just went by. And before you know it, it was 30 years. And I've just had a great time.
When you walk around the estate, which I know you do on a very regular basis, do you ever just stop a moment and just pinch yourself, just looking at what has been achieved and what a beautiful place it is?
Yeah, I do. But I also look at all the things we still need to do. So for me, it's really hard to just say, "Oh, this is amazing." And I do think that. And actually, it's when I'm up in our office on the 30th floor and I look down on it, that's when I can really think, yeah, we achieved it. And it's really only going to get better with all of the residential that's coming along. But when I'm walking through the estate, I think I see things that need changing. So it's more difficult. But yeah, it's amazing.
Is absolutely that when you're amazing, firing off messages and emails and noticing things that's not quite right, or this garden needs a bit of attention, or
exactly.
You've got an eye for detail, haven't you?
Yeah, actually, my team love it when I stay up in my office, because once I go down, they get a million emails, but they're on the same page as I am. So
I'd forgotten that, of course, it was former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher who was very much behind plans for Canary Wharf and developing that land site, which some local authorities had sort of failed to make good. And I read the speech that she gave on November the 29th, 1989, after she'd driven the first pile. And one of the quotes that really resonated for me was, "Where there is no vision, people perish." You've created a real community there. Has that been key to its success?
Oh, definitely, because it's not just about the 100,000 office workers. It's also about the community that are coming in. And actually, with COVID, that's when the community really, really came forward and actually helped us. So throughout the years, we've had the community part of Canary Wharf, and we have the office community, but they're now mixing and it's a huge community. But during COVID, it was nice. It was nice to see all the people coming in that actually lived around and were loyal to Canary Wharf.
What was driving the first pile? That's a construction term I should probably know.
Yeah.
What did she actually do, Mrs. Thatcher?
She doesn't actually drive the first pile, but it looks good.
What does it mean?
It just means the first pile that goes into the ground for the first building.
Ah,
so you need the piles in order to build the structure for the building.
So a good photo op newspapers in those days.
And everybody should have one. And we did it for Crossrail and all of the major buildings, yeah.
Now, I know that you're passionate about retail. How hard a sell was it at the beginning to tempt some good, exciting names and brands to come to that kind of area?
Impossible. It was absolutely impossible. They didn't know where Canary Wharf was, what Canary Wharf was going to be. We were telling them that there'll be 100,000 people and they only saw 5 people, you know, so it was quite impossible. But then we had some local tenants and we also had some other people that thought, yeah, no, I'm in. I think that this will be something. And then once you have a few, then it starts to grow. And then once you have your office tenants and they start to grow, the retail grows with it.
And what are your memories of signing one or two of those retail names that, you know, you just thought, yes, that you were absolutely delighted with, and perhaps ones that you knew would turn a corner to get other names in?
Waitrose. Waitrose was that moment, actually, because Waitrose, we knew, would attract a lot of people and make a lot of people at the estate very happy. So Waitrose was definitely one of those moments. Having the Third Space Gym as well, which took 10,000 people, again, it was another moment, because that is really what we needed at Canary Wharf to get the other tenants to come.
There was a time, wasn't there, when it was thought it could be a white elephant and there were plenty of doubters out there. Did you just always believe that you were going to get there by hook or by crook, even though at times it perhaps seemed impossible?
Definitely. And I remember that term so well, white elephant. I remember going to parties and all anyone ever wanted to talk to me about was the white elephant. And why did I come over from Canada? And I just couldn't believe it, because I believed in the project and look what's happened.
No, I wonder what you say to the doubters now. There's no need actually to say anything, is there? It's there.
Well, it's really interesting, because when you go after tenants and they say, no, there's not really a chance that we're going to come out to Canary Wharf. And then 10 years later, they're coming to your door and saying, yeah, can we get some space here? So it's nice.
Will you tell us a bit about growing up, Camille, and living in Toronto, and what your family did, what your childhood was like?
Well, I come from a family of 4 children. I was raised by my father. He did a pretty spectacular job, to be honest, and a few housekeepers. My sister fired them all the time. So when he would come home from work, we'd be without a housekeeper. But no, it was a very happy childhood. And I was born and raised in Toronto. And my father was very much a city man. So we lived pretty much in the heart of Toronto. And then I went to university at Ryerson College and studied architecture. And then I started working at the Sheraton Hotel part-time. And I worked for a drayage company, which brings freight in and out of trade shows. And that's where I learned to drive a forklift. They were all unionized, all the guys. So I had to do this when they weren't looking. And one of the guys was teaching me. And so I worked on that for quite a while, part-time. And then the fellow that I worked for, well, he liked to suntan a lot. So he used to go sunbathing. And so I used to hold fort all the time. And I'd say, yeah, you go, I'll look after this. And then finally, the head of the company saw I was doing all the work and sacked him. And then I took over and I was doing some trade shows. And this fellow came up to me and said, why don't you work in retail? Because you're bringing in all these trade shows all the time. They're in for 3 or 4 days at a time. You could have shops, but they're in for 10 years. You know how to read drawings. You like mechanical, you know, pieces of equipment. We could work together. And that was it. And I started working on shopping centers and then went to about 2 or 3 and then was recruited to Olympia New York.
And what did your father think to all of this and your sort of career plan and what you were doing?
Oh, he thought it was pretty amazing, actually. He thought, of course, moving to London was amazing, but then he thought it was great. He could see I was really super happy and I'd found something that I liked. And yeah, it was great.
Do you think your drive and determination perhaps comes from him and seeing what he did in his career and life?
Definitely. Without a doubt. I don't remember my dad ever having a holiday, and I'm a bit like that. I don't like holidays, so I'm sure it came from him. I get up at 5. He always got up at 5. He used to go work out at 5:30. I'd go out and work at 5:30. So I think I'm very much like my dad, for sure. And he helped me along the way as well, with just like how you trust people and, you know, how you deal with people.
I know you champion women in the workplace. In fact, you were kind enough to invite me to take part in International Women's Day at Canary Wharf, which we did together. What were the main challenges you faced in what was perceived to be a man's world as you climbed the ranks?
it really was the fact that I was in construction and I was a woman. But I feel that if you show that you've got the skill set and the passion, which to me is probably 90% of it, you can overcome anything and it shouldn't stand in your way. Too many women don't speak up.
We talk, don't we, sometimes about a glass ceiling, but did you find that the glass ceiling wasn't there because you did speak up and you did, if you like, put your money where your mouth is and get on with what you said you would do? So did you not feel really there was that glass ceiling?
No, I've never felt that there's a glass ceiling. It's just not in my makeup. So I just think I can do something. If I can't do it, I'll ask someone because I'm determined to do the best I can at any job that I do. And I'm very lucky too in my history of my career. I've worked for a lot of men. I've also worked for a woman, and they didn't stop me. And they saw the benefit, the benefit to the company.
Is there a fundamental difference, do you think, between women and men in terms of, you know, if men can do something, they let everybody know they can do it. Are we different as females and have to overcome that? Because we're often a lot more perhaps modest and shy about what we bring to the table.
Absolutely. I think that's the biggest thing to work on for women. I think that women just don't put themselves forward where men will. And women want to be able to do everything about the job, whereas men, if they're 75% there, or even 50%, they'll go for the job. And I speak to so many women within our company who are absolutely talented and passionate and such an asset for the company. And I said, but nobody knows that. You've got to get out there and you've got to let people know and you've got to apply for some of the jobs that you've won. Don't just sit there and say, I should have. You've got to go for it.
I learned the other day that there are more CEOs called David than there are female CEOs. I mean, what else needs to be done to get women right through to the top? Because they bring as much to the table, sometimes more than men.
I would say more in some ways, because I think that something and that women do bring is an EQ. And I think that that's very important in a company, the more emotional side too. And when you're in a board meeting and you're listening to a subject where you think, yes, it is all about numbers, but we need to interject some emotion into this as well, because we can't run a business just on numbers.
At the women's conference I referred to a moment ago, I'll never forget you playing in Tim McGraw's track, Humble and Kind. Have those lyrics in some ways been a bit of a mantra for you throughout your career?
Absolutely. I've had a long journey and it's been fantastic. Even at Canary Wharf, I didn't, you know, just jump right up to CAO. And it's all the people that helped me along the way. And I think it's so important to be kind to people. And, you know, don't let it get to your head as to the role that you're playing within the company. You know, you need to still deal with all the different levels. And I think that that's what makes the company.
And you've talked a lot about your team and paid tribute to them. I suppose in many ways, on a project this size, you need a fantastic team behind you, don't you?
Yes, you do. And actually, at the women's conference, Diane talked about cheerleaders. You need those cheerleaders on your journey. You need your support team in order to get anywhere. You're not a one-man band. You're not a one-person, you know, team. You have to have a number of people around you, and you do it together.
And what would you say is your leadership style?
Good question. I would say that I'm quite direct, I'm firm, I'm very focused, but I think I'm quite understanding and I listen.
And that's important, isn't it? People need to feel appreciated, don't they?
Yeah, definitely.
In 2013, you gave this quote to a magazine. My stomach always lurches at this point because I hope they didn't misquote you in any way, shape or form. But the quote was, I want to get Canary Wharf recognised as a retail destination, not just a place for business. That's the thing I want to do before I die. It's still a hurdle and would cost millions to do it through advertising. So we do the next best thing, which is to make it a really good experience and wait for people to spread the word. Now, that was back in 2013. So you've obviously already massively achieved that. But I was interested in the line about advertising. Canary Wharf isn't really advertised, is it? Is it all word of mouth?
It pretty much is, because we do advertise a bit about Canary Wharf, mostly now for our residential. So we're in the papers quite a bit now. But it's the whole development that never really gets advertised. The 16 million square feet with all of the parks and the water and the big public spaces that don't really get advertised. And with that is the retail. We have 1 million square feet of retail. It's not finished yet. It will still keep going, but we don't advertise it. You're absolutely right. We don't advertise it like a lot of people would, but we want people to, I'm probably not changing what I've said. I think you have to come and experience it, and then you'll believe in it.
You've achieved, though, that 2013 dream because it is recognised. In fact, globally, it's recognised as a retail destination. So what's the dream now?
Ah, well, now it's a mixed-use development. So with all the residential, it's absolutely fantastic. So we have one new element, people living there. And then I'd just love some yoga centres there. I'd like a cultural centre. I think there's just so much more that we could do there.
So it is a city within a city, really, isn't
it? Yes, it
is. And presumably the apartments and people having Canary Wharf as their home has given it a very different feel, I would have thought.
Yeah, definitely. They just started moving in February of this year. And it's just really nice to see people at nighttime going back to their apartments and really loving living at Canary Wharf.
And have you enjoyed the design side of that too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. The design side's been amazing. And one of our buildings has been designed by Herzog & de Meuron on it. It's an amazing building, this round building, and the detailing in the building for the balcony so they don't overlook each other, for the fact that the apartments, although it's a round building, are all beautifully square and rectangular inside. No, it's just amazing.
You have a reputation for long hours. You've said already, you've admitted you don't like holidays. You've got a real drive and passion for what you do. But how do you relax? What do you like to do when you do have a little bit of you time?
To be honest, I like walking around the golf courses with my daughter, who golfs, although she's just gone to Colorado University. And that is my best enjoyment, is just walking around with her. I'm not allowed to be her caddy. I'm not that good. But just to walk around the golf courses with her, I just absolutely love it. And I'm so relaxed. And just watching her play is fantastic.
Do you really have to be good then to be a caddy if she won't let you caddy for her?
Yeah, you should be. You should be giving them advice, and she doesn't take any of my advice. But no, I really enjoy that. I also love skiing. So skiing is probably my main sport.
I've heard that you're very good on skis. Were you virtually born on skis growing up where you did?
Pretty much skis and skates. Yeah, I love skiing. And when I first came here, when I did take holidays, they were always ski holidays.
So do you avoid holidays a bit now? I know your daughter's in America and grown up a bit more now, but do you literally sort of come out in hives when you see a fortnight booked where you're supposed to be off?
Haven't done a fortnight yet.
Oh.
But I don't like the build up. I don't like the packing. I don't like all the things you have to do in the office before you go on holiday. And then it takes me 2 days to relax. And then you've got 2 days where I'm thinking, okay, this is quite nice. And then I start winding myself up again. So that's why I don't like them.
And is your husband understanding of your dislike of holidays?
Yeah, he's pretty good. Give me a couple of days away. That's much better.
Now, you've brought your love of art into the workplace too, with some stunning pieces, not only on the office walls, but beautiful, beautiful sculptures on the estate. How did your personal love of art start? Because I think I remember you telling me once it was small to begin with.
Yeah, I studied art at school and absolutely loved it. But then there was just this great opportunity when I came to Canary Wharf. Although before that, what I would do is I would go to an art gallery and I would rent the art. And then the rental payments were towards the purchase price in the end. So I would rather have had a piece of art than a piece of furniture. And then I came to Canary Wharf and I saw that there was an art program. And I very early got into that art program with Helen, who was managing it at the time. And when Helen left, there was just myself and Sir George Iacobescu. Now, talk about a connoisseur of art. He is definitely one. And he has such fantastic taste. And I know that art is subjective, but working with him on the art has been amazing. And yeah, that's how the whole art program has evolved. And then the purchases have been mostly with Sir George. We work together on it. And it's what makes it. There's over 70 pieces of art.
What are the pieces that really stand out for you, or the pieces that you were most excited about purchasing?
Helene Blumenfeld, I love her work. She's got the most fantastic show on right now, all across the estate. Oh, her pieces are stunning, absolutely stunning. Sean Henry is the complete opposite. Julian Wilde, I mean, there's just so many. Igor Mitrai, I don't know, I like so many of them. But I think Helene, her pieces are stunning, absolutely stunning.
And how does it feel when they're brought onto the estate, presumably on a flatbed truck or craned into certain locations? It must be really exciting to feel that you've sort of written a check for the estate so that the public can enjoy these pieces. But do you get that real tingle of excitement when you see them being put into place?
Oh, definitely. And when the artist is there with you and there's probably a team of about 10 of us that are there, and just to watch it be craned into the space. And sometimes we have to move it around because it didn't work exactly where we thought it would. But it's pretty special.
And has Sir George been fun to work with too?
Oh, amazing. Amazing. I've enjoyed my last 30 years with him. On the art, it's been great. Just his ideas. He's a visionary. And to work with him has been amazing, really.
Camille, yours is a wonderful story of how hard work and drive combined with that determination and passion really pays off. Thank you so much for coming today and sharing some of those stories with us. And I hope the podcast experience, I know you don't really like doing interviews and this kind of thing, but I hope it wasn't too painful, was it?
No, it was great. And I appreciate it. Thank you, Helen.
Well, you've been listening to Camille Waxer, Chief Administrative Officer and MD of Retail for many years for Canary Wharf Group PLC. Thank you very much for your company. Please do pass on the podcast link, convex.podbean.com, to friends and family. You'll also find us on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts if you search for The Convex Conversation. I'll be back with another inspiring guest next week, so bye for now.